Live from the Hilton in downtown Hartford, this is Where We Live. We're here as part of In Practice, a conference put on by the Hartford County Bar Association. Their special guest for this conference is John Dean, former White House counsel during the Nixon administration. Dean is credited with cooperating with investigators and linking President Nixon to the Watergate scandal, but he was also called by the FBI the master manipulator of the cover-up. Dean pled guilty to obstruction of justice. He's faced decades of questions and some criticism about his role. He's written extensively about his experiences, including in the book Blind Ambition, but he's got another incredibly extensive book about the Nixon tapes coming out this July, the 40th anniversary of Nixon's resignation. The story he's here to tell lawyers today is about the legacy of Watergate and what it all means for today's legal profession. We'll be joined later by Kevin Rennie, who's a lawyer himself, but also a bulldog, a columnist for the Hartford Courant, who writes extensively about public corruption. We'll be talking with John Dean about his role in the Nixon administration and the Watergate scandal and what it can tell us about public corruption and public service today. Coming up in a bit, we'll take questions from this audience full of attorneys who I will guess are a pretty inquisitive bunch. John Dean, welcome to Where We Live. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's lovely to be in sunny downtown Hartford.
You're coming from California today. You've picked a beautiful day to be in New England.
It is. Well, actually, it's a relief. It's 100 degrees today in California.
Okay. I guess we won't complain too much. So first thing I'd like to know from you is, when you were counsel to Richard Nixon in the White House, what at the time did you think your job was? And then looking back these many years later, what do you now perceive your job actually was?
Well, you know, I found a very interesting analysis of that, not prepared by myself, but by a fellow by the name of Alex Butterfield when testifying before the House Impeachment Committee and explaining who was who in the White House and how it all fit. And he said to the committee at the time, he said, you know, John Dean never, well, he had the title, never was White House counsel. John Ehrlichman, who had had that post before I did, never gave the job up. And while Butterfield said it was no fault of Dean's, the president just really didn't look to him to be White House counsel. That's very true until the very end when he's in deep trouble. It's 8 months after the Watergate, and he starts talking to me. And shortly thereafter, the cover-up ends because I wasn't really terribly keen on it. But I think that I was a middle-level staff person. What Butterfield noted that was interesting is that I had two masters. I served both the chief of staff. I was in line authority in his office, as well as Ehrlichman, who, as I say, never really gave up the post of White House counsel either. So I had to report to both of them, and to report to them to report to the president in turn. Unless he called and asked a direct question, I would always go through that chain.
When we look back at this time, some of us remember it a little bit. Others of us lived through it. And many people, including younger lawyers who are in the room here, frankly, don't know very much about Watergate and how it came to be. I know you have discussed this hundreds and hundreds of times, but I'm wondering if you can quickly describe for a younger audience who don't get it, what exactly happened? What was Watergate?
We're still trying to figure that out, actually. I've been at USC as a visiting scholar for about two decades, and it's been at least two decades, maybe three or four, since young people had any idea what Watergate was. It's defined in dictionaries, and I actually noticed this not long after it was all had come to sort of a rest, as abuse of high office occurring during the presidency of Richard Nixon. It came very quickly, and it happens during Watergate, to mean much more than a bungled break-in at the Watergate. It becomes a symbol for abuse of power, and increasingly items are swept into that. To say it happens during Watergate when the dirty tricks start to surface from the campaign, that expands it as the first time. And the Washington Post is very effective in doing this, in broadening it out to make it much more than, as I say, a bungled burglary. So it happens early and it continues, and then everything that Nixon did that was abusive suddenly is swept under that label. In fact, when the Congress gets around to taking Nixon's papers, his tapes, what have you, they instruct the Congress and the General Accounting Office to come up with a set of regulations that define Watergate. And the ultimate definition really includes everything that the Watergate special prosecutor investigated, everything that the House impeachment inquiry investigated, everything that the Senate Watergate committee, which was actually a study of campaign practices, those all fit now under the label of Watergate. So it's pretty broad and pretty inclusive.
Kevin Rennie from the Hartford Courant, thanks for joining us for this conversation as
You're
well.
Welcome.
I'd like you to just quickly chime in, and from your perspective, what do you perceive Watergate to be?
Well, I think that the definition that you first stated is what it broadly was. Of course, what it began as was what the White House, at least in the public mind, what the White House tried to pass off as a third-rate burglary of the Democratic National Committee headquarters in the Watergate complex on a June night in 1972, because they were concerned about the president's reelection.
Actually, to be technical, it wasn't the White House that did that. It was the Washington Post is literally on the scene because their police investigator, their guy with the link with City Hall, tips them off. They are there at the scene at the same time the police are there, for all practical purposes. And they own the story from the... And they start defining the story from
it was the Nixon people who wanted to diminish it as just a third-rate burglary,
I'm going to be hyper-technical with lawyers. It's actually Ziegler responding to what we don't know at that point that sounds like a third-rate attempted burglary. Nobody at the White House at that point really understands what's going on. We're baffled. I mean, it's so stupid. There's such high risk. There's not a... I'm somebody who's now just completed a project that I should have never taken on, which was to listen to every Richard Nixon Watergate-related conversation. I thought that probably the... When I started the project, I thought probably the bulk of them had been done by the Watergate Special Prosecution Office, which did... I learned about 80 tapes. Next, historian Stanley Cutler, who forced the archives to release early a lot of the tapes, does about 320 partial transcripts of Watergate conversations. I thought, well, that's pretty well going to answer all the questions I was interested in. But the first thing I looked at is how many transcripts or conversations really were there. And there are another 600 conversations nobody even outside the archives ever heard. So there are about 1,000 conversations where Nixon is discussing Watergate. So as I say, there were partial transcripts of maybe 320. The Watergate Prosecution Office, maybe 12 of those 80 they did are really good because they were used in the trial. The rest of them are largely... FBI secretaries who took a crack at them, and sometimes they don't even know who's talking when they were trying to do the transcript. So anyway, the third-rate burglary is not an effort to consciously cast it by the White House at that point. Now, and as you know, I'm not exactly an apologist or a defender of the Nixon administration, but I have, as a result of this now, gotten this encyclopedic knowledge of what happened and when.
Well, what the burglary brought to the public,
right,
or at least led the public to learning, was this wider mechanism that the Nixon White House had unleashed in what looks like paranoia, really, of against its enemies. And of course, we have John Dean here, so I have to ask him about the White House enemies list, which became sort of shorthand for how the world began to view the Nixon White House shortly after he'd won one of the greatest reelection victories in American history. But just over a year before that victory, Mr. Dean wrote in a memo that the White House enemies list was how we can use the available federal machinery to screw our political enemies, including grant availability, federal contracts, litigation, prosecution, which prosecution really, really means criminal prosecution. When you wrote that, two questions. The first one is, what threats did Carol Channing, Bill Cosby, and every black member of the House of Representatives pose to what you call our administration?
I love the media because you take all these different things and able to cast them and recast them into a picture that
this
looks,
is the memo.
No, I understand that. But understand what happened. There are lots of threads that go to make that. First of all, I almost got fired for not writing that memo. I had refused to do it. But
you buckled.
No, I didn't buckle. I wrote a memo that I thought was so obnoxious they would reject it. The second part of the memo had an approve, disapprove, what have you, at the end of it. I was flabbergasted when I wrote this outrageous memo, giving them what they wanted. And if you notice also, my office is excluded from that operation. This is something that I don't want any part of. I think it's absurd.
But then you took this memo and the first list to the IRS.
No. Never went outside my file drawer.
Let's
get into the enemy's project because
sure.
It was a very calculated move on my part to put Watergate in its much larger context. Having listened to all the tapes of what they expected with my testimony, it was not what they expected. They thought I would go up and make charges about the president. I decided to do it very differently. I thought people needed to understand how this White House operated, how something like this could happen, where all this came from. And one of the projects was the enemy's project. It was a surprisingly small part of the project. It was run out of Chuck Colson's office, where he had a fellow by the name of George Bell, who was a dollar-a-year consultant, extremely comfortable financial person, and he would collect the names of the people who were the so-called enemies. There were, I guess, a half a dozen lists that I finally turned over. The person who this was set up with was the senator from Connecticut, Lowell Weicker, who happened to have been my neighbor. In fact, I sold Lowell my house when I left town. Took a note from him. I trusted him. Anyway, the enemy's project, I knew, would have the impact it did. And as Nixon writes in his memoir, it's the sort of thing they never recovered from. But it helped to explain in very lucid terms the mentality, which there was.
But at the time that it was created, you're talking about late, at the time it was created,
nothing happened.
People didn't know about it, though.
Nothing happened at the time it was.
Clearly they had an intent. They had just disagreed politically with
the Nixon administration. They insisted I write the memo. There are other memos in the file where Haldeman's aides are talking about Dean won't cooperate, won't write these things, won't prepare them, lets the program fall down. Nobody's implementing it. You cannot name anybody based on that program who was ever the subject of any attack, any contract was ever, in other words, the federal machinery was never used to screw them. It got tremendous press play, but it got overplayed.
Well, what I'd like to do, though, and I'll tell our listeners that we're talking with John Dean, former White House counsel for President Richard Nixon, and also with Kevin Rennie, who's a columnist for the Hartford Current. In a moment, we're going to be getting some questions from our audience here, as with the Hartford Hilton, part of In Practice. It's a conference put on by the Hartford County Bar Association. I wanted Kevin's question to lead us to having you explain a bit of the atmosphere of the administration, what led to a need for an enemies list, what led to the deep, deep paranoia and wiretapping and activities that, again, later came under this cover of all falling under the Watergate heading. What was the atmosphere at the time?
The answer is very simple. Richard Nixon. In any White House, the president sets the tone totally. If the president wears a hat, everybody in the administration wears hats. If the president has a fire in his fireplace, everybody that who has fireplaces has fires in their fireplace. Influenced tremendously by the man who has obtained the office. So that sets the mood, sets the tone, sets the style, and everything is there for one purpose, really, to please and satisfy and deal with him, both in his policy and his politics. And that's a place where the politics dominate the thinking. There's no question. It's a highly political office. And that's as true as of Nixon as it was his predecessors and his successors. So he does set the tone, and like it or not, and it seeps out soon. The media is very good at flushing this sort of thing out. It was a voluntary act for which many of my colleagues, because they knew really it wasn't as deep as it was portrayed by the media, but there were badges at one time people had who had their name on the enemies list, and they were flabbergasted to find themselves on the list. I don't know how the criteria was developed to make this list, but it made my point. That was the important thing.
At what point in your tenure there did you begin to think, these are not things or people that I want to be associated with? And what did you do at the time? Give me an example of the very first act you took in defiance of what you thought was illegal or unethical, immoral activity by those in the White House around you.
When I first arrived, I was given an assignment. I wasn't sure if anybody had been thinking what the White House counsel should be doing, but clear enough, there was. My secretary I brought over with me from the Department of Justice gave me a sealed envelope for my eyes only. And it was, had I not been at the level I was, I might not have ever been told exactly what it was. It was from the staff secretary, and it said, it had been noted in the news summary that a magazine had charged Vice President Agnew with planning to cancel the 1972 election, which is not a small event. And I wondered how he was going to do this. And the assignment from the staff secretary went on to say that this is the sort of thing that we should probably commence a tax audit of this magazine, a new publication called Scanlon's Monthly. This is my first document, and had I not been at the level I was at, I probably wouldn't have been told what it was. But I called the staff secretary, who was younger than I'm in my early 30s, and I said, John, what is this assignment from you? He said, well, it's really not from me. I go in the morning and collect the president's news summary, and in the margins of the news summary, he'll write various assignments. And he has sent this assignment, he read this piece in the news summary and sent this assignment over to you, and the bottom line was to start a tax audit against this magazine, Scanlon's Monthly. Well, I thought about that, and I said, you know, it seems I'm literally days on the job. And my first reaction is, well, good counsel tells you when not to do something, and this seemed pretty silly to me. The magazine was not successful. Nobody had paid any attention to this crazy article that Agnew was going to call off somehow the 72 elections. The whole thing was absurd. So I wrote my first memo to the president, in essence saying, do nothing. Just let it go. And soon I got back another memo saying, this doesn't address the problem. Take a closer look at this. In other words, he wanted something done. Well, the dining room in the basement of the White House in the West Wing is called the Mess. It's run by the Navy, and there's a big table that's larger than these round tables here where the staff sits when you don't have a guest or something like that, and staff comes and goes at the table, and I happened to go there one evening, and a fellow by the name of Murray Chotiner was there, and I knew just enough about Chotiner to know that he was a lawyer. He'd been with the president for a long time. He was actually the campaign manager for Nixon's first race for Congress back in the late 40s. And I was talking to Chotiner about this, and I'm saying, you know, it seems to me that this raises some questionable issues. I'm just starting to look in the tax code, and I'm not sure that there's any statutory authority for the president to do anything. And Murray looks at me and says, well, John, he said the president's the head of the executive branch. He wants to start a tax audit. He can start a tax audit if anybody wants to. And I said, well, Murray, I said, there are also some provisions in here about the impropriety of that activity. And Murray turned to me and he said, John, first of all, let me tell you something. You shouldn't be talking to me about this. I said, why not? He said, well, this is the sort of thing that's given to you, and this place operates on a need-to-know basis. I don't need to know this, but what you do need to know is that if you don't do what the president's asking you to do, he'll find somebody who will. He said, I'm just trying to, he was trying to be kind of guiding and give me some advice about how the place worked. So I took that assignment, and I'm not quite sure exactly what I would have done next, but a fellow by the name of Jack Caulfield had been assigned to my office. He had been with Ehrlichman, my predecessor. He was a former New York City detective. And Jack was on his way to the Treasury Department to have some sort of law enforcement job. And I showed Jack the problem, and because I didn't have any idea how somebody starts a tax audit. And I have reluctance about it. And Jack looks at it and says, this is no problem. I'll take care of it. He comes back to me about 10 days later and said, you can tell the president the tax audit's in the works. That was the first time I really, early in the job, crossed the line.
And we have to take a break here, but I just have to ask, because I think this is at the root of what Kevin's asking about, is as I've read your stories, listened to you speak about this over the years, there are a number of these instances like this, small and large, ones that are widely reported, ones that aren't. Why didn't you walk away and say, you know what, these people aren't doing things right? I know I'm a 30-something-year-old lawyer. I know this is a great gig for me, and it's important for my career, but why didn't you just say, I can't do this now?
Well, I did want to at one point. Very quickly, I decided after my first vacation where I took a trip to Europe, and I came back in September of 71, and I had some in a sense because of my position, but I also knew a lot of people and had a job offer, actually a couple job offers to leave the White House, and went in and told my superior, Bob Haldeman, that I wanted to leave. He said, you can't. I said, what do you mean I can't? He said, well, you owe it to us to stay through the election in 72, because I said, listen, I think my deputy, Fred Fielding, who later becomes Reagan's counsel, then serves as George Bush's, Bush 2's counsel. I said, he's quite capable and can handle this. He said, no. He said, you owe it to us to stay. And he said, what are you looking at and what's your enticement to leave? And I told him the jobs. He said, well, you've obviously gotten those offers because we brought you here to the White House. And he, in essence, told me, you're burning your bridge. You're going to be a persona non grata. You're going to pay a price if you leave because we want you to stay. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty hardball. And I, you know, nothing of great moment had happened. I had not bent the rules. I had passed it on. So I figured I would learn how to survive. And the other thing is I didn't know exactly how it was played in the big leagues. I had this question repeatedly. I was young, and I said, you know, maybe you just don't understand the way this city really works. And this is a question I have throughout my early days.
We're talking with John Dean. He's former White House counsel for President Richard Nixon. He's here in Hartford to be part of a conference put on by the Hartford County Bar Association later on this afternoon here at the Hilton. He's going to be talking with a group of lawyers about the legacy of Watergate, playing some of the extensive tapes that he has been chronicling for a new book. Also joining me on stage here is Kevin Rennie. He's a columnist for the Hartford Current. When we come back, we're going to get a bit more of Kevin Rennie's take on this. We're going to ask some more questions of John Dean, and we're going to get some questions from our audience here. This is Where We Live. Live from the Hartford Hilton in downtown Hartford, this is Where We Live. We're here as part of In Practice, a conference put on by the Hartford County Bar Association, and their special guest for this conference is John Dean. He's former White House counsel during the Nixon administration. Dean, of course, is credited with cooperating with investigators and linking President Nixon to the Watergate scandal, but he was also called by the FBI the master manipulator of the cover-up. We've been talking about his history.
I know exactly where that line comes from.
Now I want to know.
It's frequently used. It was written by a report. A CYA, I won't put the that acronym, is cover your...
something or other, yes.
Something or other.
Yes. Your rear end.
Memo by the Bureau very early. It's long before the Watergate prosecutor comes into play, and they're trying to protect themselves from an investigation they have clearly botched. And it's because they posted it online, it's gotten a lot of currency. But it is a very weak report of the FBI's fumbling.
It is a line that has stuck to you over the years, though, in many ways. I just want to quickly, before we get to some questions from our audience, ask Kevin Rennie. Kevin, a quick response maybe to John Dean's answer before, because I think this is what you were getting at with your earlier question about the enemies list. It's the role of a lawyer in the White House, a young lawyer, someone who maybe doesn't understand what's going on in Washington quite as well as people who've been there for a while, and whether or not should have done something different. Kevin, I'd just like a quick response from you and maybe a follow-up.
Well, I think that John Dean wasn't involved in politics before he became the White House counsel, and I think that today he would not, as he was then, he wouldn't have been the White House counsel.
Well, that's not true. Most of the people who have followed me are not really politically sophisticated.
But I think they have much deeper, closer ties.
I was so far ahead of my colleagues as far as knowledge of how Washington operated. I worked in the Department of Justice for the Attorney General. I was the liaison with Congress. I was the number 13th man in a 40,000 man department. I was more politically sophisticated than most of my colleagues. Ehrlichman and Haldeman had come in from California in the campaign.
They'd been in the campaign.
But that's a different type of politics than Washington politics.
What I'm saying is that a White House counsel today is more likely to have some campaign ties through. They're likely to have more have had over the course of their career more involvement in.
I would debate that with you, both on who preceded me and who followed me.
When you became the White House counsel, did you know Richard Nixon?
No, in fact, I didn't meet Richard Nixon until I'm in the job for years. I was in large meetings with him. As I said at the outset, he never really stops having John Ehrlichman as his White House counsel. I'm there doing the staff work, and there's a lot. The White House counsel files are huge, one of the biggest in the archives. But that doesn't mean you're having the interaction on a daily basis. In many regards, thankfully, because the president can waste an awful lot of people's time. And Richard Nixon talks for hours, and he's highly repetitive. That's one of the most difficult things in doing 1,000 taped conversations. There's almost 4 million words in these transcripts I did with grad students. And the repetition is just unbelievable, that he would go over the same point so many times, so many different people, and not get any different answer.
In those tapes, there is one portion that is lost to history, and that is the gap that at least reportedly was caused by the Rosemary
Stretch. Well, I did do a special appendix on the gap, and I did it because it's gotten such media interest. It has the answer to the question has absolutely zero historical significance. There are so many other places you can go for answers as to what happened on that 18 and a half minute gap. My friend Jim Robinault, with whom I'll do the CLE this afternoon, got fascinated by this subject and actually came up with one of the great findings. Rose Woods, the president's secretary, would confess to erasing at least 5 minutes of this tape. Well, Jim did some digging, and because that investigation was called off, found the one technician in the United States, the machine she did it on, a Ure 5000, was a German import. And not many people in the United States understood how it was really operated. But to make a long story short, Rose Woods could not physically, mechanically, have erased the tape she thought she erased. So,
you know, some people in the audience may not know that I believe it was on the cover of maybe both Newsweek and Time when she demonstrated what became known as the Rosemary Stretch, which was her outstretched from the tape recorder to the telephone to show how she inadvertently erased the.
It must have been quite a physical feat.
It became one of the vivid images of the Watergate scandal.
There are two lingering media questions that I decided that because they are lingering media questions.
I don't think it's just a media question about the tape. The gap in the tape it wasn't just a media question.
But it's a non-issue. It becomes after it's so mishandled when Nixon starts turning it over that it becomes a lasting media question. The answer to the question does not solve any Watergate problem. Does not give you any insight into any Watergate character. It does not give you really any kind of historical information.
What was it that was on there?
It's very simple. That's what's not. I do address this in the book because after you listen to all the tapes, you know what's on there. And everybody thinks, oh my God, it's some big issue. They don't realize in the sequence of events that when it comes up, it's after Nixon has put up his firewall defense that he knows nothing about Watergate until I tell him in March 21st of 1973. He says, I didn't know there was a cover-up. Well, of course, that's a very dangerous defense. He will actually get forced out of office when on June 23rd it's shown that he had information and is very actively involved with the FBI and getting the CIA to cancel and deflect part of the investigation. But now the smoking gun tape, the 18-and-a-half-minute gap, are a little different. The gap tape comes up on the 20th, the first day he is back after the arrest at the Watergate. It's in a conversation with Haldeman in the morning. There's already been a very lengthy conversation with Ehrlichman in which Watergate isn't discussed at all. So by Haldeman's notes, we know it's a discussion of Watergate. Well, knowing what he knows that week and knowing the timing, the problem he has, and when this is discovered, either he orders or somebody operating on his best interest realize if this tape surfaces, it will destroy his defense that he didn't know anything before March 21st. So it doesn't have to be a particularly big, important issue. All it has to be are other things that come up, like later that day or the next day. Any number of issues would have blown his defense. So it's not actually a big deal what he says. It's the time he said it.
We were talking with John Dean, former White House counsel for President Richard Nixon, and we're live at the Hartford Hilton. And this is an event that's filled with, well, lawyers from the Hartford County Bar Association.
Hopefully other people will come down this afternoon. This is a 1:30.
It's a 1:30 event in which you're going to be presenting some of these tapes and the presentation
we
that you
are. While it's primarily for lawyers and what we've been doing with this program, it's spun out of the fact I've been doing this research. And Jim and I have been going around the country. We have no sales or marketing operation. We are here by word of mouth. We do all of these. We've done about 90 of them. Many lawyers bring their spouse. Many non-lawyers come to these events. I understand this is a fairly open event, and people who are interested in this subject, we have some real eye-opening information that we share in a rather quickly moving three-hour program. So come down this afternoon.
I want to get to some questions from people who may or may not be here this afternoon. I have questions for John. What's your name, sir?
Sure. Attorney Peter Bowman from the personal injury law firm of Favano and Vandewerf.
Hi, go ahead. What's your question?
My question, Mr. Dean, first, thank you for being here. Really appreciate it. Insight is very helpful. We're here in Corrupticut. We've had our own share of corruption here. Later today, I'm taking a flight to New Orleans, another bastion of political corruption. My thought.
You can go to Chicago later. It'll be a nice little tour for you.
Doing a whole corruption tour of the United States. My question to you, sir, is what can we as a general public, as lawyers, do to either expose, investigate, or otherwise prevent what happened in the Nixon White House from occurring in our own political worlds, whether that be local or national?
You know, one of the interesting, there are a number of post-Watergate reforms surfaced. They ran from everything from creating a Watergate Special Prosecutor's Office, which existed a parallel the independent counsel. There were rewrites of the finance laws with all the money that was sort of slushing around during the Nixon years, creating an opportunity. A number of, you know, there was investigative journalism became the norm post-Watergate. But all those things have come and gone, believe it or not. And the one lasting reform that I noticed when we started on this whole thing, one of the reasons we started doing this CLE, continuing legal education program, is one of the lasting reforms is when the bar noticed that maybe 20 plus lawyers had gotten themselves across the line during Watergate in varying levels of trouble. They said something's wrong with our ethics system. The bar has never let up. While Connecticut doesn't have mandatory continuing legal education, they certainly have stiff ethics requirements. That's changed the practice of law. Everybody who comes this afternoon for a CLE credit is dealing with a post-Watergate phenomena. We will show in the program this afternoon how, to my absolute amazement, out of what I just thought was a passing moment in my testimony, creates this whole thing where we start this movement to have legal ethics as mandatory as they are. We're both in law, they're taught in law school now. There is a statewide and nationwide ethics bar examination. Continuing legal education is required in almost all states. I'm told there is a pretty healthy movement in this state to make it a mandatory situation in this state. So this helps. I can't tell what we do in our program on the ethics side is we take the rules that are now in existence and show had they had been in existence back during Watergate how they might have changed things.
But I think you hinted, though, earlier at one of the problems with ethics laws or reform of any sort, which is that invariably in politics you have people in power who want to either maintain power or get more of it. There, and we've used words like stupidity so far. Arrogance is certainly something that comes up. A naivete comes up in conversations like this. But you have people of power, and then you have lawyers or counsel who are, like you say you were, forced into situations in which they have no good option. They may be able to give counsel and say, don't do this. But at the end of the day, we have petty corruption in Connecticut cities. We have very large-scale corruption in our capital at times. How do we deal with the fact that when people in power want to gain more of it or maintain it, that they will bully those who maybe have good intentions into things that they feel they shouldn't do?
It is the most difficult problem in the whole realm of ethics, where you have a powerful figure who hires others to help him implement sometimes not always honorable ends. Excuse me. One of the things the ethics rule does do, the ethics rules in the model code does do, it empowers the lawyer in a way he or she has never previously been empowered. It gives them leverage to deal in these situations, which we'll go into this afternoon, the likes of which they've never had. And this changes the interplay between the potential wrongdoer and those who are asked to shepherd and address these issues. So that's probably the biggest change.
Kevin, did you want to jump in quickly?
Well, I have two questions. But the first one is, since you didn't really know Richard Nixon very well or personally at all when you became the White House counsel, Were you surprised at what he was like to work with?
I was. There were two Nixons. There was a public Nixon and a private Nixon. He's a very complex figure. He's a wonderful figure to write about. My editor, who's a very seasoned editor that's working on this big book where I've just done 1,000 tapes, we were going to kept trying to figure out how to cut this thing down. And I said, well, I've written this last part about as tight as I can. And he said, well, let me see if I can't squeeze out some more. Well, he didn't squeeze out much more because he said, I got caught up in the story. He said, this man is just, he never stops surprising you. And so he's a great character to write about, making it very difficult because he will do things you least expect when he does them. He's a very private man, but had a very different public persona than his private. Even his loyalist aides, I was reading something by Ray Price, who was a former newspaper person, ended up being his favorite speechwriter. And Ray, who Nixon often was very reluctant to talk about sort of down and dirty with, so he deals with different people on these tapes in different ways. You can hear he is one person with, say, Chuck Colson, who had at the time the ability to bring out the darkest side of this man, to Ray Price, who could bring out sometimes the best in him. Ray's advice to me, he wrote in his book, which is, if I had been in John Dean's situation, I would have shot myself. Well, I just didn't really think that was the option. I was ready to put a gun to my head for Richard Nixon. But he was loyal enough. He would have, he said. So I didn't know him. You do get to know him. I don't think I got to know him until several meetings after I start doing one-on-one with him. The so-called March 21st cancer on a presidency, when I go in and tell Nixon how bad things really are, is the first time I think I really meet him. Mm. And it wasn't very pleasant what I found.
We have to take a break. When we come back, there's more questions from our audience who are broadcasting live from the Hartford Hilton today. This is a day-long conference, and the keynote speaker is John Dean. It's In Practice. It's put on by the Hartford County Bar Association. We'll be back with John Dean and also with Kevin Rennie and with questions from our audience here on Where We Live. Live from the Hartford Hilton, I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live. This is In Practice, a conference put on by the Hartford County Bar Association. We're thrilled to be asked by them to be part of this day. I want to thank Vincent Valvo of the Hartford County Bar Association and Agility Resources Group for their help today. Today on the program, we're talking with John Dean, former White House counsel for Richard Nixon, and we're talking a bit about the legacy of Watergate with Kevin Rennie as well, a Hartford Current columnist. We've got just a few minutes left, so some rapid-fire questions and answers here. What's your name, sir? Go ahead.
Tom Gugliotti from the firm of Updike, Kelly & Spellacy. Mr. Dean, thank you for being here. We're grateful that you could attend, and you've been very generous with your time. I look forward to reading your book. The question I have relates to a comment you made in closing a moment ago. You referred to that famous line, there's a cancer on the presidency. And I was going to ask you, what was the context of which that comment from you came up, and what did Mr. Nixon say in response to that?
Well, one of the reasons I used that statement, this was at a point I had realized he didn't know as much as he needed to know. In fact, one of the surprising things on the tapes, when you follow them literally from the first day he's back, on June 20th, 3 days after the arrest at the Watergate, until I start dealing with him 8 months later, while he knows much more than he's letting on to me, he doesn't know as much as he needs to know. He's making decisions very early where Haldeman and Ehrlichman, in fact, often after being asked a direct question, do not give him a good answer. So he is shielded. He is not getting the information he needs to make decisions. Not necessarily you would have made a different decision, but he at least didn't get that option. By March 21st, I'm going in there to tell him there's a confluence of events. I'm being asked to write a bogus report, so-called Dean report, that the president has announced. The first time I learned about the report, is when he announced it, that he said he, under his personal guidance, had instructed me on cutting and conducting an investigation I had not conducted. So he wants it written, and I'm not inclined to write it. Then for the first time, somebody who, one of the defendants, sends a message to me, Howard Hunt, that he's expecting $120,000, and if he doesn't get it by Wednesday, he's going to have seamy things to say about the guy he worked for at the White House, John Ehrlichman. These come together, and I tell Nixon, I tell Haldeman, because there's a protocol in how you talk, when you talk to the president. Told Haldeman, I said, I'm going to go in and tell him some of the problems. He said, do it, because no one really had. They had given him bits and pieces, so to make sure I had his attention, sometimes when I'd go in, he'd have both feet up on the desk. And he had them up that morning, and that's when I told, and we had a little chit-chat going in, and I said, Mr. President, there's a cancer on your presidency, blah, blah, blah. And his feet were on the floor after I said that. In fact, that's the, when he writes a note to his diary that night, he said, well, Dean came in, and he gave us this cancer on the presidency thing, and that kind of got my attention, which is why I used that that metaphor, which I think was explanatory at the time.
We have just a few minutes left. I have to ask you something. In our current world, we've spoken a lot about what one can do when one sees great injustice going on around him, and what price you might have to pay. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the actions of Edward Snowden, the former NSA contractor.
Well, you know, technology changes radically and dramatically, as it has. Human nature, in my some 70-plus years, doesn't seem to have changed very much. So I think we see the repetitive issues that come up and up again and again. Of course, the best-known predecessor of Snowden was Dan Ellsberg. It's a very difficult problem. One of the reasons I see a real difference between Ellsberg and Snowden, which did similar things under similar circumstances at different times, is Ellsberg clearly was prepared to stand up and account for himself after he had made the decision he made. He knew it was part of the decision, that he had signed commitments. They're even tougher today, like Snowden signed, that if he violated the law, that he would stand to be punished by it. So if you're gonna blow it at that, you know, blow a secret at that level, you really have to be prepared to take the consequences. That is something he is just not resolved on how to do. It's important. There is a whistleblower law that is post-Watergate that does provide some protection for people like that. He decided not even to use those channels, which might have been available.
But because we just have 1 minute left, I'll just ask you very quickly, do you think he did the right thing?
Well, I think it's the right thing that he got the evidence out. It's not the wrong thing. It's the wrong thing not to be willing to stand up and take the punishment.
John Dean is former White House counsel for President Richard Nixon. He's here in Hartford as part of a day-long conference happening at the Hartford Hilton In Practice. It's put on by the Hartford County Bar Association. This afternoon, he and one of his colleagues are going to be presenting not only a history of what happened in Watergate, but also presenting some of the extensive tapes that John Dean has chronicled and listened to all of for a book that's coming out in July around the 40th anniversary of Nixon's resignation. John Dean, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it today.
Thank you.
I also want to thank our friend Kevin Rennie, who is a lawyer, but he's also a columnist for the Hartford Current. Thank you for asking some incisive questions, as always, Kevin, and it's good to see you.
Thank you, John.
I want to thank the folks from the Hartford County Bar Association, thank my producers, Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. The executive producer is Katie Talarski. Anna Novak is our intern today. Thank you so much for joining us live from the Hartford Hilton. This is Where We Live.